So check this out. Jonathan Beakley, he's an occasional guest host here at Above the Basement. He's created this really amazing app. It's called Pro Jammer. It's a play-along drum app that makes learning new drum skills really easy and fun. Pro Jammer contains a series of drum lessons, each of which consists of a continuous loop of original multi-track play-along music, expert guidance, and drum transcription. You just plug in your headphones and play along. The Pro Jammer app is free. Just go to the Apple App Store on your iPhone or iPad and search for Pro Jammer. Check it out and let us know what you think.
She's got the moon in her eyes, and it's getting me high as a marzipan sunflower. Built to be guided like a Caroline Bell Tower. She's got the wind in her hair, and I don't mean to stare, but it floats like a shy cloud. Stars on her cheek, and Andromeda speaks, whispered promises unbound. And as she dances across the sky, higher than Icarus dared to fly, she glances down at the crowds below.
Folks, this is Chuck Clow from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. The talented Greg Loafman is an in-demand bass player, composer, and teacher. He fronts the indie band Loman and the jazz trio Sinistral, and he is a member of several other bands, including the phenomenal gypsy jazz group Rhythm Future Quartet, Roving Soul, and Man on Land. Greg also performs with many others, including John Funkhauser, Britt Connors and Bourbon Renewal, and the Sonic Explorers. Greg had just returned from marching in Washington, D.C. for the Women's March on Washington, and we were glad he returned in time to talk about how he has changed his focus when playing not only as a band leader, but also as a sideman, and how that change has affected his songwriting. It's a really interesting approach, especially for all the musicians out there. Before we begin, I'd like to talk briefly about Bridge Over Troubled Waters, a cause that we support here at Above the Basement. For 46 years, Bridge has been a national model and program innovator for youth development services, reaching youth where they're at, helping them overcome the effects of abuse and neglect, and assisting them to prepare for and attain training, jobs, and economic security. Today, as the premier agency in Boston serving homeless youth, Bridge provides its wraparound continuum of care approach to services for 3,000 youth each year. To read more about their services or to learn how to get involved and support Bridges, go to bridgeotw.org or go to abovethebasement.com and click on our charitable causes page. Okay, so back to Greg. You just heard a cut off of his Loman project called Garden of Rainbows, and halfway through you will hear one from Rhythm Future Quartet called Iberian Sunrise. So here's our conversation with Greg, recorded at Woods Hill Table in Concord, Massachusetts. But you were just in D.C. over the weekend.
For the
march. You marched?
I marched, yeah, me and my wife. Yeah, got on a bus Friday at 11 a.m. and supposedly we were supposed to get there at 8 p.m. Got there probably closer to 9:30 just from traffic and whatnot.
And was there a lot of people on this bus that were all going to the march?
Yeah, exactly.
So that's part of the experience too, in a sense. I mean,
right.
Were you all singing songs on the bus on the way down?
No, actually, it was all pretty tame. I thought that might happen.
Yeah.
I was worried that it was going to happen and then keep happening for 8 hours. And I was like...
But everyone had a pink hat?
Yeah, everybody had a pink hat. Yeah. I didn't have a pink hat.
Yeah,
so
that's okay.
Everybody but me.
You were there to support the pink hat.
Yeah. I should have had one. Anyway, I didn't get it together in time.
Well, I think so. How was it? How was the march?
It was pretty surreal. So we got on the train to go to DC from Alexandria, which is like I think 4 or 5 stops or something away. And the first two trains that came were just completely jam-packed, wall-to-wall people.
Yeah.
We were able to crowd ourselves onto the third train that came. You know, then we got to the station, like the station that most people were getting off of, and it was crazy. The wall-to-wall people from the station to Independence Avenue. The speeches were, I think, Independence and First or something like that. We were Independence and Ninth, and we could not get any closer at that point to the stage. Then, because there were so many people, it was like from there all the way down the mall to the Washington Monument, just like packed, jam-packed along that whole street.
Like, is there like some kind of organized path?
Yeah.
Like, where do you march?
They had a route to march, kind of like down one street and over another, and then over eventually to the White House. They thought they weren't going to be able to march at a certain point because there are just so many people even get started.
They're saying it's like one of the biggest marches in U.S. history, or I don't know of all time. But
yeah, well, especially
with every city that it was in.
Yeah,
I mean, it was everywhere. So
even globally,
Yeah, globally too. Right.
Yeah.
Well, and they really try to make it about the positive too, about what it really stands for, what it's not anti.
Right. I mean, there were a lot of people there who were not happy about the Trump administration.
I would imagine.
To put it mildly.
Oh, yeah. The signs were pretty powerful statements.
Yeah. It was more like an affirmation of these are our values. And, you know, a lot of the criticism was there's wait until they do something and then protest that. But that doesn't seem to work. Like, once the horse is out of the gate, it's kind of too late. You know, then you're chasing after a galloping horse, to strain the metaphor. This is more like, okay, you got elected, but that doesn't mean we're not here. That doesn't mean our minds have changed. It's kind of like putting somebody on notice. Like, you know, like the opening moves in a chess game. You're not just going to like sit there and let somebody else make 5 moves before you make 1. So I think that was the message, like, to the extent that you're going to move against the principles that people are fighting for in the march, know that it's going to be a fight, that there are people who are going to be engaged, that are going to make a lot of noise. Actually, before I came over here, I was actually on the internet, and I was making up a spreadsheet of all the representatives. I'm going to do it with the senators too, all their names, what their state is, what their district is, what's their phone number in Washington, but also what the committees are that each of them are on, which, I mean, you can find all this information, but it's not like in a spreadsheet that
it's
you can
readily
organize.
It's not in one place.
So like now it's like if somebody goes after, say, like them going after the ethics department, I can go to that spreadsheet, organize the spreadsheet, and like, okay, these are the people that are on the ethics committee, and then start making phone calls. And so once that's all set up, I'm going to share it with anybody who wants it. And,
oh, good for you.
You know, and it's one of those things, like, really, it's no matter what your politics are, it seems like it will be a useful tool.
Yeah, sure. And, well, good for you, man. It's commendable.
In D.C., was there any music there?
Like, before the march, so like there was like a bunch of speeches and stuff before the march. So Alicia Keys sang something, Maxwell, and there was another. I need to go back and find out who it was. There's somebody who started like kind of like a chant type of a thing. It was kind of like set to music, but it had the mothers of people like Trayvon Martin and people like that who, you know, have been killed. And basically the chant was like the mother would yell their son's name, and then like the crowd would chant back, say his name.
Wow.
And so it was really powerful.
In the song.
All set to music. And
But they say that there wasn't any arrests at all.
No.
That's what I heard.
Not a single one.
No.
Yeah.
Which is pretty amazing with the millions of people who did this.
And very few counter protests too. Like there are a couple people, like the usual suspects, like Westboro Baptist Church kind of people who, you know.
I love those guys.
Yeah. They're hilarious.
Yeah.
I swear, I think it's like an Andy Kaufman-esque, you know,
it's like
20-year social experiment or something.
Yeah, it doesn't seem real. Anyways, we didn't mean to talk politics, but it was an important thing, and I think it's interesting that you were there.
But take that line. So I mean, why don't we segue into music? Have you're a writer, and you write lyrics as well.
Mm-hmm.
But do you sort of bring in some of that to your writing, or is it more personal relationships? Or I know that you had a song about the bubble boy.
Oh right, So that was probably that's probably the only like kind of like even slightly political song that I've written.
That's a political powerhouse. That song was. I like that
I'm
song.
Trying to segue here.
No, it's
again. I've tried. I mean, I can't write personally. I've done some songwriting, and I haven't had any political statements in any of my songs. But you know, I don't know, but some sort of slice of life type of stories can sort of hit home. And, you know.
I think that's when it's most successful, or when it kind of resonates most with me. But there are people who do it and do it amazingly. It hasn't been what I've gravitated towards. You know, I'm not kind of dismissing the idea that it might happen. And like some of the songs, I've been like writing a little bit less frequently for Low Man, which is the band that I write more pop music and sing and have lyrics. I've been writing like very slowly for the past couple of years, but some things that are emerging are a little bit more. Even like before this election, there was a couple songs that seemed to have this post-apocalyptic vibe to it. It was helpful for me musically. At a certain point, I kind of stopped caring on a certain level, and that sounds bad and sounds wrong, but I'd had like a kind of an exhausting year where I'd like, you know, I'd gotten divorced and had like fairly major surgery and this, that, and the other, all sorts of things just kind of piled on at once. And like, I kind of came out of that thinking like, the music I play is the music that I play. How I play it is how I play it. I'm done with any kind of ambition. What kind of came from that on a certain level was like this Zen nihilism. If nothing that you did mattered, what would you do? If you knew there was zero chance of success in any kind of way, what would you do? What you would do, you would actually be coming from a place that like it means something to you personally. It kind of takes any kind of external carrot out of the whole equation. Mm.
That was sort of a conceptual framework that you were going with when you were starting to write.
Yeah, and, or just when I was, yeah, well, I was kind of
in
like
that state.
Right. I was kind of trying to reframe my relationship with being a professional musician, because there is a lot of, especially being a sideman. Like, I mean, I'm a bass player. I'm usually hired by other people to play their music or music that they kind of choose. So there's always this aspect of wanting to be the person that you think they want you to be. So the Zen nihilist philosophy to that would be, you have zero chance of being the player that they want you to be. So be the player that you want to be.
So that's interesting. So after you went down that path, what did you find was the result of it? Was it a relief?
Yeah, in a lot of ways. I was able to let go of a lot of anxiety, especially playing improvised music.
Yeah.
If you're holding on to what other people might be thinking of you while you're trying to play, you're dividing your mind on a certain level. I think I let go of a lot of that and just kind of like went for something that I thought was cool. And some people might have liked it and some people didn't. And luckily, the people that I like playing with seem to have liked it all right. And maybe other people didn't and they stopped calling me, but I didn't really notice any noticeable change, except that people said that I seem to be playing stronger and playing with more confidence.
That's fantastic. I think that it's almost something that every musician should do. Stop trying for a result and for that reward, whatever that might be, and you can be yourself. And those are the people who end up being signature players, people who have a sound, and people who they want to go to you because Greg's going to do what he's going to do, and he's going to add to it, not just to do what I'm going to ask him to do. That must be a really powerful thing for you, I think, right?
Yeah, and it's funny, like the other kind of metaphor that eventually came to mind as I was working through this, there's a scene in Coming to America with Eddie Murphy where like he's meeting all of his potential wives, yeah, you know, and like he goes up to one of them and says, "So do you like movies?" "Oh, yes." "What kind of movies do you like?" "Whatever you like."
That's right, whatever you like.
You know, so like everything was like, "Whatever you like." And I was like, no, I don't want to be in a relationship where there's nothing, I'm not getting anything back. Right. I'm just getting this kind of poor reflection. And that's what I was, not always, but I would slip into that too much in my own playing. Like, I would just be kind of like, "Whatever you like," in terms of what I thought people might want from a bass player at that moment, when really what they want is you to bring your full self to the table.
So I mean, it's interesting because that is a self-selection as well. It's sort of Darwinian in a sense, where you are going to over time be that guy that they look for, that's going to, you know, a little bit what they want, but you're going to bring your zest and your spice to it and your Greg Lohman to it. Have you been a session player or in a group where they say, "We want you to do exactly this," and you get any enjoyment out of that? I'm getting a sense from you that if you did that all the time, it'd be completely not what you want. But that if that's a part of your job, do you find that that's something that would be enjoyable?
Even if I'm not super passionate about the music that I'm being asked to play in the moment, I'm very passionate about doing my job well. And it's really frustrating to me when I fail to do that.
Because it's a cool skill when you think about it, to be able to do that. And at the same time, let yourself go and be the creative sort of right brain guy and creativity guy. but to have that ability to do it precisely.
Do you prefer one or the other, improvisation or going note for note, whatever's on the page?
I think I'm more comfortable improvising.
Yeah.
So one other thing, like kind of like to this idea of playing what somebody else kind of like writes for you, note for note or whatever, or playing their arrangements and everything, kind of for better or for worse, but I think some in a lot of ways for better, I'm a lot less shy about speaking up when I think something could, say somebody writes me a bass line and I play it a couple times and I play it in the setting and I'm like, this just doesn't work. But if I change this and this and this, then it would work. I just do it a lot of times, or I'll if it's like a radical change, I'll point out like, I think at this section, this bass line isn't working, but something like this would, and I play it for them. And if they say, I don't like that, I go back to what I wrote, I say, that's fine, you know, and that's also part of the Zen nihilism of it, is like just letting go of attachment to your ideas. You know, I don't need to have an egoic attachment to my opinions even, you know, like of like what an arrangement should be, what a bass line should be. I also shouldn't like be afraid to voice them. And when I started doing that more, I got a lot of surprisingly positive feedback, like, oh yeah, okay, that works better. But it's also made me a little bit less of a tractable sideman for some, you know, like, and I have my own preferences, and sometimes I let those get in the way. Like, I don't really like reading music, and I really don't like sight reading complicated music in front of people. Part of it's maybe just, it's my weakness. I'm not a huge sight reader. But part of it, I feel like the more complicated the task you're setting to me, the more likely I am to screw it up. And that's like not me, but anybody, you know. So let us all improvise, and then we'll just all play how we normally play, especially as a jazz musician. Whereas like if you're saying, okay, improvise in this section, but this section, do something crazy, then loop back to this section, then this goes into rubato, then goes, it's like you get all these, every these little pivot points are like chances for things to kind of fall apart and not be super happening. Whereas if you do a much simpler arrangement or no arrangement at all and just trust the professionalism of all the musicians in the ear of all the musicians to come up with something, it's going to sound more organic, it's going to flow better, and it's...
So how do you work with the Future Rhythm Quartet, where they're all, you guys are all just ridiculously killer musicians? Are you reading there, or are you you just know the song and then you just kind of improvising as you do it? Every time you, for example, if you have a song, are you doing something the same thing every time you're doing it live, or are you changing it up? Or
it really depends on the song. But a lot of the stuff on the latest record, the Travels record, will have sections that are arranged that are pretty much set. Yeah. But the way that we come up with them a lot of times is somebody will bring in something in that's not really finished. Like you've got a melody, you've got chords, you've got ideas for the form, but you don't have the form written out. And then everybody just kind of like starts to like say like, oh, what if this happened? What if that happened? And like, because we tour a fair amount, like we've done a lot where like, okay, we're in this town now for 2 days in a row. We've got the afternoon off. I've got a new song. Let's put in some time and see if we can come up with an arrangement. So that happens a lot. And sometimes the tune comes in like 90% done, and like 10% is like everybody figuring out their own parts. And sometimes it's very seldom like that. So the one tune that I wrote on Clear in the Future record is Iberian Sunrise. So I brought it in and it had like an intro that lasted like 16 measures or something like that. And then it went into the song, and then it had a little tempo change, and then went into the solos and ended. And immediately when we started rehearsing it, Jason's like, no, this intersection has to be much longer and we need to come back to it. And I was like, I don't know how we're going to come back to it. We can make it longer, and we figured out how to do that. It's like, but I don't know if we can come back to it. We just kind of like worked a couple different ways and found a way to get back to the first part of it. And that was something that happened over like the course of, you know, a couple rehearsals of it. And then we would like basically would practice it during sound check, run it. And then once we got to the point where we could run it straight through on sound check and sound pretty good, we would try it out on a gig. That band has been really kind of fun in that way, because there's a lot of collaboration to it. And it's not like most things you get off of the written page pretty quickly just from repeating it while you're trying to work it out. And obviously Jason and Ole and Max are all incredible musicians. You can give them this crazy complicated thing and they like play it for 30 minutes. Like, hey, I got that. You know, so.
I hate those people.
Yeah, it's pretty insane. It's been really inspiring, though, too. I guess it is possible to have that much command of your instrument. Thank you.
listening is a key to this, right? I mean,
right.
It's not just, you know, it's technically amazing what's going on and the chord progressions and the arrangement and coming back to the 16 bars. But there's got to be, let's get rid of the egos, let's listen, and let's figure out who's next, how you pass the ball. It's like reminds me of sort of like, you know, I was just watching my son play basketball the other day, who's like, you know, they're getting better and better and better. But, mm-hmm. you know, you imagine these professionals that are just, they're in sync with everyone.
Right.
And passing the ball. And
it becomes intuitive, I guess, right?
There's a lot, especially, and this is the advantage of playing a lot together. And the other group that I've played a lot with over the years is with John Funkhauser mm-hmm. and Mike Connors in John's trio, and then also in other situations with, like, adding other musicians and things like that. But that core trio of me and Mike and John has played together a lot. And so, like, we know how to kind of, like, breathe together and move together. And, if I leave a space, somebody will step into it. Or if I make a gesture, people will frame that gesture and move into a new musical space. And so...
Is it visual? Is it... Tell me about that. Dive into that a little bit with the three of you. So
okay.
The gesture, the sound of it, what do you think happens there? In that exchange?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, there's a lot of just kind of, especially once you know the material that you're working off of really well, there's a lot of just trying to turn small moments into larger moments. So, like, it's really difficult to kind of describe, but if John were to play something that has, like, kind of like a very washy kind of thing, then all of a sudden we can take, just say, like, that happened, and then move on to something else, or kind of, like, hold what we were doing against that. Especially that trio has a lot more of a tendency to be, like, as soon as somebody makes, like a gesture like that, okay, let's change the whole framework to be that now. And so, like, there are these kind of natural shifts that happen in an organic way. Like a lot of jazz, it seems like there's like the rhythm section is kind of chugging along behind the soloist, which is cool too, and it's a totally valid way of playing, and I like playing like that. And we get to a lot of places that we may have never gotten to before. You know, like I said, anybody can kind of spark it. I can play like a really short note and then lay out, and then the way that Mike and John react to it make me think like, okay, I'm just going to lay out for the next 2 minutes and let those guys play.
When you're communicating, you would almost feel as if it's prospective in the sense that what you do and what you play is going to cause this reaction. When you look back on it, was it actually the sound of the notes and the timbre or the sort of the rhythm that actually caused someone to get it? They knew that Greg was giving me a sign right here. Or is it just sort of, they do it, you drop back.
Right.
It's hard to know.
Yeah, it depends on how much you're kind of framing your playing around that. I think that happens subtly in all styles of music, especially in all styles of jazz. For the Rhythm Future Quartet, like if we're chugging along on an up-tempo swing tune and Max is playing quarter notes and I'm playing quarter notes, I'm not going to like all of a sudden go into free jazz land. That's just not what happens in that style and in that band. Yeah. And I think there's parameters built around like the style that you're playing and the people that you're playing with. Last year or so, I've occasionally played the early set at the Lily Pad on Monday nights. The early set is with Jerry Braganzi and Phil Grenadier and usually Luther Gray on drums. And then the late set is The Fringe, which is George Garzon and Bob Galati and John Lockwood. And they've been playing free jazz, like completely free jazz. Like they come in with no set plan. And the way that they navigate that freedom and the way that they do kind of what I was talking about, and like where the way that like they can take one thing that the Bob Galati plays on drums, and then all of a sudden that turns into a groove. Like he just plays like one thing, and then like the way that they respond to it turns it into a whole, like, you know, it could be 5 minutes of music based on like a three note thing that one person plays, and the way that they can move into things like that and out of things like that and develop them. So if you think of like on one end of the spectrum is order, like complete order, like almost like classical music where everything is written out, everything is structured. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is chaos. Nothing is planned. Nothing makes sense with anything else that's going on. Jazz is always in the middle there. And if you're playing off of structures, like playing a song or playing a standard or whatever, you're introducing chaotic elements and you can drift more towards chaos and then drift back to structure. A lot of times when free jazz happens, when it happens well, in my opinion at least, when it happens well, is what The Fringe does. It's like they start with chaos and they build these structures and then they fill them out and then they just let them dissipate or let them meld into a new structure. So they're kind of like building these cities that evolve and then maybe they dissolve, but maybe they just evolve into a new city. And like, it all happens in this really beautiful, organic way.
Well, it reminds me, I heard an interview you did where you're talking about improvisation and being present. I mean, I guess that kind of goes back to your Zen nihilistic.
I think that interview might have been before my Zen nihilism revelation.
Oh, really?
Or I don't know, maybe.
But it is
pre-Zen nihilism.
But it is interesting because, you know, sometimes when you're playing a song and you know how the song goes and you want to get to a certain portion of that song, whether it goes to a bridge or something, and sometimes you may decide to go into like a little riff off of a solo or to stay on a certain chord and just stay there for a little while. It's the listening which forces you to be present, but without looking at an end point.
Right.
Whatever you said was really good. I like how you said improvisation, it forces you to be present if you want to do it well.
Yeah. And you know, I think I said that's not my natural state of being.
Right, that's what you said.
You know, it's like my natural state of being is like I trip because my head is in the clouds and I'm like walking down the street and I don't realize there's a...
I don't think it's anyone's real state of being. You have to work at being present.
Right? Yeah, I mean, that's where the kind of the Buddhist thing really interplays a lot with, not just music, but I think anybody who's in the zone and like, when, you know, athletes talk about being in the zone, or I can't imagine being a waiter, you know, and having to like wait on 20 different tables and like keep all that in my head and like, okay, who needs water? What, you know, all the things that waiters have to think about. Like,
yeah, I don't know how they do it.
I'd have a nervous breakdown, but people who do it every day and they're like,
you know. I was going to say, I get stressed out actually when I'm at a big table with people and a waiter can remember everything that people have ordered, very specific orders.
Yeah.
I'm like, he's not going to remember.
And you're like, did you want to write this down? He's like, no, I got it.
But that's funny. Like that kind of reaction, I think I've had that reaction when people will call a jazz standard and be like, okay, well, I do this song, but I do in this really weird key, like this kind of obscure song in this really weird key. And I'm like, okay, like, do you want the chart? I'm like, I'd rather not read it if I, you know, I know it. I'm like, but do you, what's in the key of D flat? And it's like, yeah, that's fine. You know, just cause that's the skill set, you know? Yeah. That's the, you know, as a bass player, that's a valuable skill set, especially if you're going to work with singers. You got to know a bunch of standards. You got to be able to play them in any key. I mean, you don't have to know the melody. You don't really even have to know the chord. You just have to know the root motion and be able to hear the chord qualities.
You know, people have done work, psychologists, and they've done some other studies in neuroscience about flow.
Right.
And that state of flow, like you said, athletes are in or musicians are in. And I think it's really interesting what you talked about from the state of chaos and the spectrum down to structure. Mm-hmm. Because that chaotic period is really kind of about those moments of flow, I think. You're in the zone, you're not thinking, but your brain is letting yourself be in a different place. To me, the musicians that have the ability to actually make those notes work, the muscles in the hands are actually able to play what they want to play. You're not always thinking about what you're playing at that exact second, and that's flow. Hip-hop artists do it all the time, and they've studied hip-hop artists, where they know that people can sort of make these rhymes and these...
But the connections that they can make.
They're able to make these rhymes that are not necessarily always conscious, because they're in flow.
Right.
And jazz really speaks that language.
I think so, and I remember I read one thing a while ago about, I guess there's a nerve in your gut that goes directly to your brain, and it's like faster than most of your senses on this weird level. But I think like one of the things that they said was that the body reacts to a loud noise before the ears can register that it hears the noise, and the brain can process that it heard something. The body's already reacting faster than the sound could go from your eardrums to your brain and figure out that you heard it. When you're really improvising, you're kind of bypassing consciousness on a certain level, and you're just hearing and reacting with things. Like if I had to stop and think, okay, we're playing an F chord and that person played an E flat, so that implies an F dominant chord, so I better, you know, what are my options on an F dominant chord again? If I have to like go through
it's already
that
too late.
Yeah, like the chord's like, you know, long gone by that point. The idea that you can just hear and react without even having to think about what you're reacting to or how you're reacting, it's almost like an ear to hand connection that bypasses the brain entirely.
That's cool.
A lot of times, and then sometimes you do have to engage your brain, so you have to kind of go back and forth, especially depending on how tricky the music is that you're playing.
This has been very deep. I don't know if I can. My brain is starting to get tired. You do a lot of different things. You did in a lot of different bands. We were just listening to, what was the one we listened to? Skyfoot.
Oh yeah,
we were digging that.
I love that stuff. You know,
those guys are great. They're great musicians.
Is it one tune that you played on? Were you on the whole album?
Yeah, that one I was on the whole album. Like I think at that time they were working a lot as a trio, and the singer and keyboard player was like playing left hand bass, and then the drummer and the guitar player playing. So I'm not sure how much they're still touring as a trio. I think they have like a more or less permanent bass player now. But kind of like in that time, they're like, we want bass on the record. We don't have a permanent bass player. And they had actually taken John Funkhauser's jam band class at Berkeley. So
he's a jam band class. That's what he teaches. That's one of the things he teaches.
Class, really?
Yeah, he teaches. Yeah, like an ensemble, like a jam band ensemble. That. Oh, yeah.
That's really cool.
But that, how was that for you to do something totally different?
It was cool. It was an interesting kind of like, I haven't listened to a lot of jam band music, but so these guys, I feel like, really went a lot of interesting places, and you know, had interesting compositions, and you know, and executed too. They're all amazing musicians. So it was fun, but it was interesting. Like I did listen to more jam band stuff before we did that recording to try to get in the headspace, but then at a certain point I was, you know, I'm just going to like apply my sensibility in my ear.
Bring your own style.
So. Is Lohman your main personal project?
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that I have any like main personal project going on nowadays, that's probably the one that I'm most of a front man.
But so was Lohman fulfilling a hole musically that you wanted to fill? I mean, because certainly their Future Rhythm Quartet is certainly what do they call that?
Gypsy jazz.
I mean, that's a very certain genre. By the way, today's Django Reinhardt's birthday today.
Django's birthday. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you didn't know that.
I don't know who that is.
Oh, gosh. We'll
have to
educate you after this.
Is he a gypsy jazz guy?
He's the gypsy jazz
guy. Oh, really?
Django Reinhardt. Anyway.
Django Reinhardt.
Okay. Sorry. I will get educated and look him up.
The guitar we were hearing before where he's like... That's what he sounds like.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah, it's a specific type of guitar that's used in that genre pretty much exclusively. That's
insane.
It's an acoustic guitar, but it's a very loud acoustic guitar that has a lot of projection and a lot of mid-rangey kind of sounds.
So I'm sorry. So I didn't mean to interrupt, but back to Lohman, what was that?
Yeah.
What does that do for you? Is it because you call it an indie band?
Yeah, yeah. Like if we go back to 2008, I guess 10 years ago or so, I kind of fell into playing with a couple guys. I luckily fell into the situation where there was a couple guys. One guy named Rex Hussman and another guy named Jeremy Gustin. They had started a group called the Rex Complex. Rex was the singer, and he also played accordion and this African xylophone called a gil. Jeremy played drums. Great guys and really creative songwriters, and it had this edge to it where there were songs, and they were writing, playing songs not in a jazz style at all. They were definitely rock, indie kind of compositions. But there was a lot of improvisation to it. There was a lot of energy to it that I really liked. And what I realized from playing with that band is that I listen to a lot of music like this, but I never play it. So when those guys moved to New York, and I didn't feel like moving to New York, so that was kind of it for me with that group. They kind of moved on. But once they kind of moved out, and that group was kind of, I felt the absence of that group. And I was like, I want to play music that is like this, music that is like the music that I like and that I listen to a lot. So that was what I feel like, well, I can try to like join a band that's exactly what I want, but you know, there wasn't anything like that was exactly what I wanted.
So not a lot of bass players that will start their own band, be a front man, and have more rare.
Right. Well, I think that was also, this was, you know, it was all kind of like happening with the whole, you know, circling back to the Zen Nihilism thing. Like I think there was a part of me that liked that style of music, but didn't explore it like songwriting wise. Like I really didn't have a lot of confidence in it. And I thought like, well, if I'm just some horrible songwriter, then people are going to think less of me as a musician. I know I'm a decent enough bass player now. Why wreck it by doing something I don't know anything about?
But did you also start singing? Is this the first time you started singing for the band?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'd sung like back up a little bit with a few people career, but I'd never really sang as a front person. And being a front person too, you have to, you know, if you're going to be self-conscious, it's going to project. People are going to notice that. People are going to see that like you're not really performing, because I feel like being a front person, you really have to be kind of an energy avatar for the audience. They take their cue in terms of how they're supposed to react to the music from you. And that's something that I really saw with Rex from the Rex Complex, Rex Hussman. Like his energy in front of the band, in terms of the way that he moved, the way that he sang, the way that he, just the energy that he projected, you could feel it like go, it was huge. When he would get on that stage, it was just project this massive amount of energy, and like the whole room would like respond. And I never thought of myself as being the type of person who could have that level of energy. And I don't think I do have the level of energy that Rex have, but I have my own kind of energy. And it was interesting for me to step into that role and to try to like, okay, how do I bring energy into a room? How do I project what I want the reaction to be and all those things?
It's a different job description. You know, have to be on all the time. And, you know, I'm reading this autobiography, Phil Collins, actually, who came out. It's called Not Dead Yet. And it's a great book. I was a huge Genesis fan. And he talks about 1975 when he was the drummer for a few years of this very culty, amazing, you know, grassroots band, but it was so instrumental. But Peter Gabriel was this like lavish frontman with these crazy outfits and stuff. Right. And people would go to the shows to see Peter. And then, you know, they looked for like, you know, 100 singers when he left the band.
Right.
And finally, they interviewed all these people in the audition and finally came to him because they realized that he could sing. He would mention that he had his hands in his pockets at every gig. He never touched the microphone for like 6 months, basically. But then it happened. And then it was this amazing transformation. It's in some people, but, you know, it's a whole different...
Yeah.
And he was actually not, you know, he was just with a microphone.
Right.
It doesn't matter. It's the same thing. Even if you didn't have the bass guitar with you, I would think that you would have that same type of learning curve.
Although I think, you know, having an instrument helps. It's almost like a security blanket in a lot of ways. You
right.
know?
It is.
And so like you can always kind of like just go back to like, oh, I'm just playing my instrument and this is something I know how to do.
How is your bass playing different when you sing?
Much more rudimentary because singing and playing is hard, you know?
Because is your brain, do you think you're consciously focusing more on your vocals than your bass?
I think I have to. Yeah. I think my muscle memory is a lot stronger than my vocal ability. You know, there might be people who've been singing their entire lives who you can wake them out of a dead sleep and ask them to sing something and they can nail it. But that's not me. You know, I wasn't as creative or interactive, which isn't necessarily a bad thing for rock stuff especially. And that was the other thing that I feel like I got some insight into how to play behind a singer by... noticing what worked, what didn't interfere with the vocal that I was trying to sing and what did interfere in my own playing. Like if I would try to play something and I'm like, oh, now I feel like I'm stepping all over myself with what I'm trying to sing by what I played. I'm like, oh, maybe that would also be the case if I were playing behind a singer that's not me.
You're from Ohio, right?
I am.
Why did you come to Boston?
Well, the short story is I was married to somebody who got a job in Boston.
Okay.
The longer story is I had a lot of great opportunities to play with people in Ohio. I was in Columbus, Ohio, which is where I went to school and where I graduated from. There's a lot of amazing players in Columbus, Ohio. But I was starting to kind of chafe a little bit in terms of like my own ambitions, for lack of a better word. Anyway, so that that relationship didn't work out, but I ended up really liking Boston and wanting to stay.
So. Yeah, I mean, you didn't go down with Rex to New York, so you wanted to stay in Boston.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things. Like, I'd like to ascribe high-minded motives to why I didn't, but I think there's also a laziness factor that I have to acknowledge.
That's reasonable.
Because, I mean, it's so hard to break into any music scene. It takes a lot of time. You got to pound the pavement. You got to introduce yourself to people. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money. So I didn't really feel like doing that again, especially in New York, where like you've got the best players in the world. It's a really competitive place. And again, in that same Zen nihilism thing, like the idea that I would have that ambition. My whole philosophy was you try something ambitious like that and nothing's going to happen. So you better really want to live in New York. And I don't really want to live in New York. I mean, New York is an amazing city, obviously, but it's, you know, I don't think I would be as comfortable there as I am in Boston. So there's that. And then there's also, I really love the musicians that I have been able to play with around here. I love the musical relationships and friendships that I've been able to develop around here. The only reason for me to move to New York would be to try to make a quote-unquote name for myself. And I don't really care about having a name for myself. So that was what took it out for me. And I don't think I would be playing with musicians who are better than the musicians that I'm playing with here in Boston if I were in New York.
Well, as far as having a name for yourself, even awesome name for a bass player.
Yeah.
But it's not pronounced Lohman. It's pronounced Luffman, right?
Yeah, Loafman.
Loafman.
Yeah, yeah. Although
we have a problem here pronouncing all of our guest names. It's a recurring theme.
Yeah, it's Scottish, I guess. So it's probably Lochman.
Because my last name is Clow, but it's pronounced the same. It's spelled the same way with Clough.
Right. Is that Scottish as well?
Or? Yeah, I'm a mutt.
It's supposed to be Clough.
I've heard Clough and Clough. Click.
Click?
Click, yeah.
Because I've told you before, when I do Siri call Chuck, it says calling Chuck Clough.
Chuck Clough, yeah. Clough is a more common way of pronouncing it, but that's close. Are you going to play something for us? What are you going to play for us? You said you were going to surprise us.
I hopefully I will. Like when I started writing for Low Man, one of the first songs that I wrote started as an arrangement of a Leonard Cohen tune. So what I did was like I took that song, put a different bass line and, you know, imagined that kind of like a different drum groove to it. And then from there, I was like, okay, well, this is very different than the actual song. And then I like changed a couple of the chords, not too drastically, but I changed a couple of the chords. Once I did that, I was like, well, this is not similar to the original version of this Leonard Cohen song. So, well, what if I just wrote a new set of lyrics on top of that? And so like, I kind of like gradually like took a song that I liked. And this is actually something that I kind of stole this idea. I mean, a lot of people do this, kind of like write what they call like contrafacts, you know? So it can be as simple as just like writing a new melody to a new 16 set of chord changes or whatever, or it can be, you can like kind of replace everything. But one of the ways that Jeremy Gustin would write for the Rex Complex was that he would take a song that he liked, that was, he had a response to, like an emotional response to, put on headphones, play the drums along with it, and kind of like improvise different ways to play grooves around it, record himself doing that. So you can't actually hear in the recording, you're just hearing his drums.
Oh, cool.
And then he would like go back and listen to it, find a little section that he liked, loop that, and then that was the new groove, and then like write a song on top of that, which I thought was a really interesting creative way to do it.
Huh.
So like it was kind of that idea. But anyway, yeah, so what I want to do is, especially with Leonard Cohen having just died recently, the original version that I heard of it was in a movie called Pump Up the Volume. It was the way that Concrete Blonde did it. So it was that song Everybody Knows. That movie really resonated with me when I was in high school.
And Christian Slater, right?
Christian Slater, yeah. So when Leonard Cohen died, like right around the same time that Donald Trump got elected, I went back and listened to that song, and I was like, wow, this is really relevant. So in terms of the pessimism that I was feeling, and I'm kind of prone to that anyway, and kind of naturally pessimistic person, but I'm not, you know, not angry about it. I'm kind of like, yeah, everything's probably going to be bad, but oh well, we'll have fun.
Very nihilistic of you.
Oh, well, I try, you know.
This song's going to suck.
Yeah. So with that in mind, like,
it's a good delivery because we'll be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, that's the goal. All right, so this is Leonard Cohen's Everybody Knows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded, and everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the battle's over, everybody knows that the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight is fixed, the poor stay poor and the rich get rich, that's how it goes. And everybody knows that the boat is leaking, and everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody's got this broken feeling, like the father or the dog just died. Everybody's talking to their pockets, everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. Well, that's how it goes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows that it's now or never. And everybody knows that it's me or you. Everybody knows that you'll live forever when you've done a line or two. Everybody knows the deal is rotten, old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. And everybody knows that we're in trouble, and everybody knows what we've been through, from the bloody cross on top of the Calvary to the beaches of Malibu. Everybody knows it's coming apart. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. And everybody knows. Everybody knows. Everybody knows. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Okay, so Ron and I really loved Greg's thoughts, and we may become nihilists ourselves. Thanks very much to Greg for his great story and conversation. You can check out Greg at gregloafman.com and also at rhythmfuturequartet.com. Go to our own website at abovethebasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen, subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Remember, Boston Music, like its history, is unique. Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation is recorded at beautiful Woods Hill Table Restaurant in West Concord, Massachusetts. Woods Hill Table owns a farm in Bath, New Hampshire, where they raise their own meat. They offer a full raw bar and fresh fish caught off the coast of Massachusetts, and they even harvest their own maple syrup and honey for use in the restaurant. Local farms supply all their vegetables and grains, and Chef Charlie Foster uses international cooking techniques to create fantastic, seasonally focused cuisine. Go to woodshilltable.com for reservations or call 978-369-6300.